We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls. Today, we have access to a range of very powerful, compact devices, some of them things that are small enough to fit into a shirt pocket, things that can offer us access to information at any time and just about anywhere. In fact, we are at a point now where we actually have to make a deliberate effort to be out of touch. And while there are arguable benefits to this kind of technology, there's also some reason to think about what this information information overload is doing to our health. And our guest for this hour of the show is a tech writer. He's written for The New York Times about this very thing, what these kinds of technologies do to us, the way that we live. He's written some interesting things about not only how it affects people of grown-up age, but also how it affects children. All of that has been published in the paper. And he will be visiting the campus to talk about a little bit different topic next week, talk about relations between reporters and scientists. So that's something I'll tell you about later. He's also written a couple of novels. He's a novelist, cartoonist, and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Times. He makes his home in San Francisco and, as I said, writes about technology and its impact on society. He wrote a series for the paper, Our Brain on Computers, that was published in 2010, looking at how it is this constant use of these devices impact us. He also did a series in 2009 about the dangers of multitasking while driving, and that won a Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. Has two novels, one Hooked, his first. It was a big bestseller, and a new one that's coming out in May, Devil's Plaything, that we'll probably talk a little bit about too. So as we talk with Matt Richtel in this hour, questions are welcome. As always, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can email us, will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you're welcome to get involved in the program. And Matt Richtel, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm good.
Good, good. Well, you know, I guess the point to start out with is, and this is not like a great revelation, but it certainly seems that if anything, this trend for being connected, being on the information grid, if not all the time, at least the potential is there. We have these devices at hand. They can be right next to us. And at any point we want to, we can be there. They say, if anything, that trend and the trend for having more devices being internet enabled, if anything, that's going to become more and more.
You know, we are sticklers for language in our business, and sometimes I hear the phrase, ubiquitous, miniaturized, connected screens, and I focus on the word ubiquitous, and I think, are we being hyperbolic? And then I hear that, you know, at base camp in Everest, you can get a Wi-Fi signal, or when you go to a campground somewhere, and I'm starting to think that word ubiquitous is not over the top.
Well, and it does seem to be the case almost anywhere. I'm sure there are still places on the planet where a cell phone won't work, but that over time there are less and less of those kinds of places.
Well, look, I should be less glib. I mean, just some numbers. You know, we consume about three times the amount of media that we did in 1960, according to researchers at the University of San Diego, and the nature of that media is vastly different. It's interactive, and it is everywhere. And to your point about getting a cell phone signal, you know, actually there are some pretty good reasons why we will find the cell signal in every nook and cranny that are business reasons apart from the simple business reasons that the companies want to make money. I mean, that's the one that pops everyone's mind. But if you think about going into countries that are still developing, it costs a lot less for a society to have a wireless signal than to dig lines in the ground, say across a Spartan African plain. It would be much wiser to send that signal wirelessly if communications is your end game. So there are a lot of reasons. We'll talk about some of the physiological and social and psychological reasons we want to be connected, but there are a lot of even larger kind of societal reasons why and economic reasons why we're trying to connect everyone.
Sure. Well, I'd like to have you talk a little bit about a piece that you wrote, and it was published in the Times last year. And it's something that certainly, there are people here, as we are away from the coast, we do read the paper. And so here we were surprised one morning in the summer where we open up the paper. And who is on the cover? Here's a picture of Art Kramer, who is professor of psychology here, who is part of this trip that you also went along on, where a number of neuroscientists, really prominent neuroscientists, decided we're going to take this trip and we're going to go to this place where even if we wanted to use our cell phones, we can't. And kind of see what happens. What's the effect on us? How does it feel? And whether we're going to think that that's a big deal or not. And you went along.
Yeah, the story. When you first hear it, it sounds like the punchline to something. Because we're used to turning on the TV and seeing tough man in the wild goes days without eating. Eating only berries and grub worms. On the animal planet, in crazed animals in the wild. This was neuroscientists in the wild. And the idea was to spend 5 days with these five preeminent scientists, among them Art Kramer, as they went to this remote area of Utah and got on rafts, camped along I think it was the San Juan River. Now my memory is—I can tell you about why my memory might be fading.
It's all that time you're spending on the commuter, yeah.
You also might be having two young children and not sleeping as much, but that one I don't think we need to document in the New York Times. And they went to the San Juan River, and this was an area where there was no technological connections, no power outlets, no cell phone signals. In fact, professor from Kansas, we went under this sort of bridge where cell phone signal ended, and he said, he shouted out, "It's the end of civilization." and the idea, there were a couple ideas. One of them was for them to observe themselves, not in kind of a rigorous scientific way, but just in a casual, informed way, as they disconnected from technology. How did their emotions change? How did the way they communicate change? How did the way they approached the world and their analysis change? But that was part one, and part two was for that to inform their research going forward as they develop ways of understanding the impact of technology on us and the impact of withdrawing from technology on us. Let me just pause and say, does that make sense?
Sure. Oh yeah, well? Perfect sense. Yes.
So what they discovered on some level was would go under the heading of duh. I mean, it was like they discovered that they got a little bit more lucid, that their conversations flowed a little bit more, that they noticed things around them. I mean, there was a moment where one Johns Hopkins scientist said to me, we were in a canoe as the days kind of rolled on, and he said, I'm hearing more birds than I heard when I got here. Now, you might, as I said, this might fall into the category of, well, thank you very much, New York Times, for stating the obvious. But we are getting scientific techniques to help us understand what that means. And what these scientists, at least some of them, say to me is that it is highly significant what this means in the respect that how we pay attention, how we focus, is something that goes to the heart of many kind of psychological disorders, from ADD to even to schizophrenia. Are we, as one scientist put it to me, a myriad of illnesses are a function of paying too much attention, becoming overly focused on something, or not paying enough. And in an era where our attention is feels so divided, the extent to which these devices divide it, the extent to which these play on and affect our attention may be much more material than the duh you might associate with, oh, I feel more lucid.
Yeah. Well, that it makes me think about I'm sure that people understand that, you know, you rest, you sleep, because the body needs to rest from physical exertion. Well, there's also something going on here with the brain, clearly, and that during the daytime when we're awake, I mean, there may be times when our brain activity is at a 10, and maybe when we're asleep, our brain activity is at a 3 or something like that. But, you know, there maybe are times, used to be more times during the daytime when we're awake and conscious, that maybe our brain activity is at a 5. Well, there's some argument to me for the fact that when we're conscious, our brain can't be at 10 all the time.
Yeah. Can I step back and do a very brief and not very complicated, because I'm not able to do very complicated, explanation of some how the brain works?
Yes, please.
And then to address that question directly.
Sure.
To all the neuroscientists and neurologists listening, I apologize in advance for the simplicity. But I've learned enough that I think I'm getting it generally right. A key part of our brain, as if they're all not key, but a key part is the frontal cortex or the prefrontal cortex. It's the last to evolve, the last to mature. It's a part of the brain that neuroscientists, doc, physicians, scientists think makes us human, if you will. It's kind of a control center of the brain. So as we set priorities, as we figure out how we want to spend our time, this part of the brain is key in helping us order things. Now, it is also in some ways almost under, if you think of it as a control tower, headquarters, it is under duress a lot from other parts of the brain that are pinging it, sensory parts of the brain, saying, here's new incoming information. How should we reorder priorities? And the example I like to give is imagine yourself thousands of years ago, yourself or your forebears in a jungle, and they're and he or she is building a hut. Now, this is a long-term. This is something that takes the frontal cortex, the control tower, kind of setting a long-term project, setting a long-term goal. But all of a sudden, in the background, in the periphery, something with claws and fur on its face appears, and the sensory cortices says, holy cow, or maybe holy lion, prefrontal cortex, do we keep building the hut or do we run for our lives? That dynamic's been going on forever. One of the things that neuroscientists say is happening today is with all the incoming stimulation, we are pinging our prefrontal cortex, our frontal cortex, a lot with interruption, saying, what do I do? Do I pay attention to what's on my, to the project I'm working on, the conversation I'm having? Do I turn my attention to the roadway where I'm driving, or do I turn my attention to my device? Now, I have a sense we're going to get into this later. I'm not going to tell you all the reasons why that device is so compelling beyond what I've just told you. There are other reasons why that incoming ping is very compelling.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a dynamic that's gone on for a long time that neuroscientists say is particularly heightened now. Now, I want to add to that a direct answer to your question. Let me again pause and say, am I making sense, or have you fallen asleep? Are you texting?
I have a rule. No texting during the show. I just try to hold to that.
David, I also have a rule which says that I expect that very frequently people will text while I'm talking, so I'm not
really.
It'll balance out somehow.
Oh boy. Okay. So anyway, I'm with you. Go ahead.
So let me just. We can go more into that dynamic in a second, but if you so desire. But the where downtime fits in is not only the frontal lobe, frontal cortex, and the prefrontal cortex need rest, but there is some nascent research that indicates that when the brain rests, it synthesizes information, and it learns and remembers. And absent rest, that it has trouble digesting and metabolizing information the same way. And may I cite one? I can cite a handful of studies, but may I cite one that sort of underscores it?
Uh-huh.
Is at the University of California at San Francisco, rats, they measured the neural activity of rats as they had new experiences. I think they used an EKG, EEG.
EKG, I think, is the one for the heart. So I think it would
EEG,
be
thank
EEG.
And they they watched as the rat had a new experience, they could see new neural activity in a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is thought of as the gateway to memory. And when the rat had downtime, that neural activity spread out to the rest of the brain. So let's say the rat climbed on a new table, had never seen it before, new neural activity, then the rat takes a nap. They can track that neural activity as it spreads to the rest of the brain, whereupon that new table becomes sort of part of memory, part of learning. But absent the downtime, the neural activity didn't spread out to the rest of the brain. And what the researchers hypothesized, they were careful not to be too definitive about this, but they said, look, that may well be what's happening with us when we are constantly stimulated. We miss out on the opportunity to have things spread out into learning and memory. I should pause here and give just a little bit of a gigantic, massive asterisk, which is it's about this time in the conversation where someone looks at me and goes, what sort of Luddite are you? Don't you realize that my computer, maybe I might not remember something, but my computer is telling me my directions. It's got all my stories stored. Name the myriad ways in which technology helps us. No doubt. So please take giant asterisks, unless there's a better word than giant, like humongous, says lots and lots and lots of benefits. And this is in the spirit of saying, hey, there might be some things we didn't realize or that are unintended that are going along with the benefits. Now, back to that study about the rats. There are other studies that reinforce that, the idea that absent downtime, we can miss out on the full benefits of synthesizing information and learning it. That is benefits for all the efficiency benefits of technology. That is certainly one that would create some inefficiencies.
Well, I'm sure that the scientists who are working on these questions would say right now that we have a lot of good questions. We're still looking for answers. But having said that, how do you approach this question of balancing the potential benefits? And certainly there are benefits of this technology with the potential downside. I mean, where is the line over which you don't want to step?
Are you asking me as a journalist, or are you asking me as a user, human, parent, friend, whatever?
Well, you could give me you could be both. Just give me one, and then give me the other.
Well, I mean, let me first start as journalist. Maybe this is too much inside baseball, but I think it. If I were listening, I guess I would want to scrutinize. You know, are you asking fair questions, or you know, where are the fair questions, and where have you gone too far in asking questions? My response to that part of it is, I've thought a lot about it. Is that a lot of our job when we do it well is looking at change and new things and new developments and tension points or points of interest and trying to get at the unobserved, the unmined, the hidden truths. And at this point in the reporting of this subject, my observation is a lot of these questions have not been asked, and so everything is fair game. But in answering them, I think we have to go to great lengths to acknowledge, I don't want to say objective benefits. I mean, I'm not, you know, only time will tell what anything has wrought in our world, from manufactured food to gasoline to technology to, you know, who knows what, sunscreen. I mean, that's for millennia from now to be able to tell us big truths like that. But I think if I can acknowledge the fairly clear benefits of technology and tell the stories in a way that doesn't create a horror story, doesn't create the proverbial NBC, you know, the local news station saying your microwave will kill you, tune in at 10, then I think I've been fair. And just one point, at the risk of sounding a little bit defensive on this, our narratives on these stories took great pains to find people who were both benefiting from and struggling with technology. So you've mentioned one story in this. Mm-hmm. There were a handful that focused on different characters dealing with heavy technology use in their lives. To a person, they were also benefiting from it. Okay, that's the journalistic answer. The personal answer is, and by the way, I should say again, did that make sense? Should I?
Yeah, no, okay. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
The way I've learned to think about this from researchers is to think of technology the way we think of food. And what I mean by that is food is essential for life. It's – thank you, New York Times. and in that same spirit, technology is essential for modern life. But some food is better for you than others, and too much food is a problem. It's a gluttony. Similarly, technology can be harmful in certain ways of in certain consumptive levels, and some of it can be distracting. There is, I'm sure we'll get a little into the science of this, but the reason researchers really like that analogy is, as they think about this sort of addictive, very compelling nature of our devices, some have been tempted to compare it to, say, drugs. I mean, even Nora Volkov, who is the head of the National Institute for Drug Abuse, a very well-regarded neuroscientist, said to me, technology is rewiring our brains, quote, and then I'm paraphrasing, that it works on the same kind of mechanisms as other addictive substances in the brain. But she and others were careful to compare it more to a kind of a food addiction or even a sex addiction rather than a drug addiction. And why? Well, it's hard to make the case that cocaine has life-giving purposes. I mean, I'm sure someone could make some tangential argument, but food certainly does, and sex certainly does. They are life-giving, life-preserving at their core. They can also spin out of control. No one would say, don't eat or have sex. But they might say some people have a problem with those life-giving, what would you call them, entities, life-giving things, and so too with technology.
We're at the midpoint here. There are a lot of things we could talk about. I have a caller, and for anybody who's just tuned in, I also want to introduce again the guest, Matt Rechtel. He is a novelist. He's a cartoonist. He is also a reporter for the New York Times. He lives in San Francisco and writes about technology and its impact on society and how it changes the way that we live. He wrote a series for the paper, for the Times, Our Brain on Computers, and he also won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting for some articles that he wrote about the dangers of multitasking while driving. And if you'd like to read those, you can go to the New York Times website and read them. His first novel, Hooked, was a national bestseller and has a sequel, The Devil's Plaything, which is scheduled to be published in May from HarperCollins. And he is going to be here on the campus. Maybe I'll mention again real quick. that he's going to be here making a visit next week, Thursday, April 7th. He'll be giving a talk 11 o'clock in the morning in the Beckman Auditorium, and he'll be talking about journalists and scientists and how they relate to one another. And then after that, there'll be a panel of folks from science and the media to discuss some of these issues. And the College of Media is one of the sponsors for the visit, also the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science, which is currently directed by Art Kramer. I mentioned him earlier. He's a professor of psychology here at the University of Illinois and was part of this, was involved in this article that was published in the paper last summer that we that I mentioned right at the beginning of the show. And I know Art had a lot to do with asking you to come to talk. So I want to mention him and mention Beckman. And for folks who would like to be in on the conversation, you can call us 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And let's talk with someone here who is on the phone in Belgium, the community, not far from us. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to both of you. I may have an interesting perspective on this for you, sir. I also have to tell you, as Mr. Inge knows, I'm talking to you from a rotary dial black phone. I am the ultimate Luddite. But at the same time, I spend a lot of time in San Francisco. I'm there all the time. I have two children that live out there. One lives in the Richmond. The other one lives over in Sunset. And I never use an automobile when I'm out there. I always use public transportation. And I walk around a lot. And when I'm here in the Midwest, well, I don't use that stuff very much at all. And I spend more time driving and stuff and getting around. And I've noticed that, obviously, in San Francisco, they use a lot more of those little magic boxes you're talking about, and everybody's on them all the time. They have time when they're driving on public transportation to spend the time dealing with it. And that's what I'm really talking at. To use one of these devices, you spend a lot of time. I don't have that kind of time to devote to that particular aspect of things. Yes, maybe they might sort out information nicely for me, but I really don't have the time to play with them, to get to be, competent with them, to get addicted to them, to really make the most use with them. And I find that even here in the Midwest, you don't see them quite as much as you do out there. And I think it might actually be with the fact that you have enough spare time to develop the relationship with them to make them function.
Well, I don't know, Matt. You have some thought. Well, if this guy wants to see people using these devices, all he has to do is come over here to Champaign-Urbana and walk down Green Street in the middle of campus, and they'll see plenty of people with them.
It's a couple things come to mind. A lot of great observations. I mean, I would say to the caller, first of all, if you're using a landline phone and you have grown kids, it may be that you are in a particular demographic that makes it, that is not a function of your geography, but, you know, your commercial choices, to some extent, maybe your age group. I mean, this stuff is, the mobile phone has been adopted faster than any technology in human history, I think. I'm fairly sure of that. Don't quote me on it, but that's the illusion that I think I heard in passing, and tends to make sense to me. Certainly faster than the TV. So the other thing with regard to how people are using it, you know what? I happened to be on the subway the other day, and I noticed all around me people were using their devices, and the journalist in me thought, I wonder if that's interesting, but I quickly dismissed it in the respect that, you know, people got on subways and picked up newspapers and magazines since the advent of the subway. In fact, a little bit of extra trivia, the heyday of newspapers came in part because people were getting on public transportation and wanted something to do. I mean, in that respect, these are digital newspapers or magazines or crossword puzzles or what have you. That's not remarkable to me. What is when people start, and what has been the nature of the series the last 2 years, is when that stuff starts to become the nature of the interactive component of it starts to be different than the newspaper of years past in a way that either distracts us and is dangerous, like in distracted driving, or distracts us and makes little nicks and cuts in our ability to focus or reach our long-term goals, as in the more recent series, Your Brain on Computers.
Okay. Well, yeah, I want to thank the caller. We have somebody else here up in Homewood, which is to the north of us. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Uh-huh.
I'm kind of the opposite of the gentleman earlier. I'm actually learning it. I'm not an old poop. I've basically lost my old job, and I'm learning new techniques. I've always been on a computer, but I'm just now getting into it. And they just announced this morning on TV that there was going to be tens of thousands of jobs in Google and Facebook and Yahoo and all those places. So I'm brushing up. I'm going to start taking classes at the local college and learn a lot more. Because I'm enjoying it. I'm in my 50s, so I'm tired of doing the grunt work. I'd rather be doing the brain work on the computer, so I'm enjoying every single of it, you know, minute of it. Time flies, though, when you're having fun on the darn thing. Like, you know, the same thing is going with the phones. I love the phones. Anybody that has a landline, I don't know, I hardly use my landline anymore. I use it for business, and if it wasn't for my business, I wouldn't have one at all. I think it limits you in a house. You know, if you have your own regular phone, your cell phone, like I'm talking on now, you can go anywhere, do anything, and people can bug you whenever, so you don't have to wait and have a regular answering machine. The only downfall is, like you were saying earlier, texting or driving with a phone. That's a no-no until they figure, and it does distract people. And until they, you know, put some kind of device in a car where, like, instead of you got the GPS thing, built the whole thing in to where you have a Bluetooth in there, you could talk through your GPS unit or something and not have to worry about it and do the handheld thing, you know, so where you don't have to dial it by hand yourself, you know, voice activated. I think that's coming if it's not already here. But I'm a little behind in that stuff. I'm just wondering your comment on it.
Yeah, I'm glad the caller raised this question about cell phone use or maybe other wireless use in cars. This is something that you've written a lot about. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was that, you know, given the fact that there's a lot of research to show that this is a problem, distracted driving is a dangerous problem, it doesn't seem to be something that is getting very much attention either from, you know, from your average citizen or from government.
So it's an interesting it's a great question. It did, right in the wake of our series, and it depends who you ask whether the series was responsible for this, although we've gotten a lot of people saying it was. Obama signed executive order prohibiting federal employees from texting while driving on the job. The Secretary of Transportation, I think he's from your area, Ray LaHood, former
uh-huh.
congressman.
Yep.
He held a distracted driving summit, and he's come out very fiercely on this issue and called distracted driving, quote, a deadly epidemic. I've rarely seen a politician be stronger and more resolute on an issue. He's really gotten on the stump about this. And then, Oprah, isn't she also from that? Wow, there is a huge Chicago tie. Now I'm realizing it's all about Illinois. She made hay of this. A number of states have passed laws around texting and driving, but there is a really a compelling point that you kind of you allude to. About 50% of people say the roads are less safe than they were 5 years ago, which is a remarkable number if you think about the fact that's from the AAA Foundation for Highway Safety. It's a remarkable fact if you think about that we've got anti-lock brakes, we've got safer cars, we've spent billions on roadways and other efforts to make travel safer. They say that their chief concern, the drivers, around why roads are less safe is distracted driving. A lot of that is owed to the phone. However, the very people who say, I mean, they will say they are terrified of others driving while distracted using a phone. They also say they do it all the time. And so what our series, if I had to pick a single word that defined that series, to me it would be, the word would be disconnect. The disconnect between what we do ourselves and what we want to do and the fears we have of other people doing the same thing. And it may explain the answer to your question, or even the question, why aren't people doing something about it? Why are they continuing to behave this way? Well, they seem to think it's okay when they do it, but not when someone else does it. I'm sure that's hardly unique to this subject, but it is certainly very pointed when it comes to this subject. Now, I don't know if you want to do more callers, happy to do that, but I can also explain a little bit why the technology seems so compelling to people that they're willing to do it, even if they think it's dangerous when others do it.
I have one more caller here. Maybe we can come back to that. I'm going to find myself wishing, I'm sure, when we're done, that we had more time, because there's so much really interesting stuff we could talk about. But rather than make this other caller wait, why don't we get to them? And then I do want to come back to this, because I think earlier in the conversation, we teased at this question, well, why is it we just can't leave it alone? And that's a good thing to talk about. Let's get a caller here in Champaign, and this is line two. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
My question is a little bit different, although I'm fascinated with the topic that you're on right now. I really want you to get back to it. But mine has to do with emotional reactions, if you will. After my husband died, my family decided to have a kind of gathering on a mountaintop in Colorado. And there were seven of us who actually got there. Me as the eldest of the eldest generation, five of the next generation, and only one grandchild could make it because of college and jobs and whatnot. We found almost immediately after we arrived, we all had cell phones, but we found that only one of the cell phones worked because of the problems with the terrain. The only one of us, we were there for a week, and the only one of us who was really uncomfortable with that situation was the granddaughter, who was then a 25-year-old law student. And I'm just wondering if that tells us anything about generational issues with these devices. The rest of us sort of shrugged and said, okay, so this phone doesn't work. But she kept ragging her uncle, who had the one that did work, to make calls and to receive calls and so forth. Any comments?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a good subject you've raised. Do you have about 4 hours?
No, you don't.
Well, first we'll do the big asterisks on this one. You know, when you're 25, probably your social life is in full bloom. You want to stay. I mean, I'm sure when I was 25 and went away with my folks on vacation, I was also wishing I was talking to my friends.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is one piece of it that has to do with that. But I will. There are two things about this that make this, one that makes it generational and one not so. Let me do the not so first. What the research seems to indicate is if you're habituated to constantly interacting, to constantly being stimulated, then you crave it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it may be that she among this group, I don't know, but that she among this group spends so much time with her device that in its absence she feels bored.
Well, that was the way we interpreted it, both the generation of her parents and I as her grandmother. That's what we all thought.
But the reason why I say that's not generational is, trust me, I've met lots of people, and at times I can be this way, much older than your granddaughter, who become so habituated to using the devices that we feel bored in its absence. That piece of it could happen to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
The piece of it that has a generational component is that I mentioned the frontal lobe earlier,
mm-hmm.
the part of the brain that is involved in setting priorities. It's also involved in deferred gratification. For instance, I'm sure it stands to reason, it's obvious that when you're older, you can put off some pleasure knowing, you invest your money
mm-hmm.
and things work out, you know it's going to work out better later. When you're a kid, you have 50 cents, you go buy the candy immediately.
Okay, deferred gratification. But, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, that's interesting.
So what the researchers say when it comes to our technology, that young people, because that part of their brain is still developing, it is still not fully mature, it is harder for them to ignore the incoming stimulation. It is harder for them to, say, ignore a text message while they're doing homework. They want to respond to the immediate gratification. That is a little different from what your granddaughter was experiencing in that she was reaching out with her device, not constantly responding to incoming pings. But that is by a long way of saying some of it's generational. Some of it is just probably a function of the fact that she, like lots of us who use these devices, have become so addicted, really, if you will, so habituated to using them all the time that we feel bored when they're not there.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
That helps a lot. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Well, you then have made some stabs there at answering that question that we said we were going to get back to, and that is why it is that we just can't, why we can't leave this technology alone, and why some people at least find it so difficult to unplug.
Yeah, so should I take that head
yeah,
on?
Yeah,
yeah. Again, all with under the heading of a lot of this is great, a lot of it serves us beautifully. I would hate for people to walk away and say, it's not a cell phone, it's a bottle of gin, because no one is making that comparison, certainly not me. But here are some of the qualities that make it hard to put down. Researchers talk about a kind of adrenaline rush, a mini adrenaline rush that someone gets when the phone rings or it buzzes with an incoming text. And I'm sure it would be hard for me to believe that most people in the audience listening wouldn't connect to this idea that it buzzes, you go, I wonder what that is, mm-hmm. on some very basic level. The researchers talk of a dopamine squirt, a little burst of neurochemicals, and the more accustomed you get to that little burst of adrenaline, the more you want it, just like anything else. And so in its absence, as I said, you feel bored. That is a physiologically addictive experience. Not addictive. It has an addicting quality to it. I don't want to call it addictive. It depends to what extent you indulge it and how it gets in the way of other things. That's a physiological issue. Let me give you two psychological elements that reinforce that. psychiatrists, psychologists talk to me about something they call the lottery ticket syndrome. When you know how you get a lot of emails in a day, 50, 100, most of them are nonsense. They could be spam. It could be the president of Zaire telling you he can make you a bunch of money if you just send an email. It could be whatever. But within that pile, there might be one or two that are fascinating. You don't know which ones they're going to be. So you never know when the good one's going to come, and you feel compelled to check all the time as a result. That is a very powerful psychological lure. It's called intermittent reinforcement. One other thing that makes this so powerful, I mentioned the idea of going back thousands of years to our forebears. Well, let's go back to that same village, no lion this time, but someone walks up to you and taps on your shoulder from behind, some other villager. Well, of course you're going to immediately turn around. You're very primitively programmed to do so. You want to find out if that person is opportunity or threat. In fact, one of the things we're most basically programmed to do is respond to other human beings. Well, Now imagine that your device, people in the village, the big global village, can tap on your shoulder anywhere you are, anytime. You are programmed to respond to that on some very basic, you know, human level. So here you are trying to avoid your device while you're driving for good reason, but all of a sudden everyone's tapping on your shoulder. What are you going to do?
We have maybe about 5 minutes, and so in true interviewer tendency, I'm going to ask you a question that we could talk for another hour about. Given all of this, and particularly some of the earlier things that you said about things that we think we know about the fact that constantly being bathed in this information environment may indeed impede things like learning and possibly also impede creativity, how should one think, or how do researchers think about the effect of use of these technologies by young children?
So I alluded to that. Again, a great question. You're right. Let's get ourselves a couple of large pizzas, and we'll solve this over 10 hours. But the short answer is that, one, they're careful to tell me and have me tell the readers that let's not be too quick to single out kids. That's the big – I know I'm constantly giving caveats, but I want to be responsible with this. And so this is something that impacts all of us. But when it comes to kids, that key part has to do with the immaturity of the brain and the frontal lobe in particular. And what the worry of researchers is, when it pertains to kids in particular, is that not only will kids have trouble orienting their priorities when information is coming in, but, and this is maybe it's certainly among the headlines of the work in my own mind that I've done the last few years, is that it can actually change the way the brain develops. Now, this is very, again, very cutting-edge research, still developing, but the way the hypothesis works is that our brains develop very much with in regards to our environment. I mean, people know this as a matter of course. You're raised in a home where there's lots of reading. You're going to develop your reading skills. Your folks teach you how to throw a baseball. That those parts of your brain that emphasize that will develop differently of your coordination. And similarly, if you're constantly switching tasks, if you're constantly going back and forth from your homework to your text or from the TV to the phone, the fear of researchers is that when the brain is developing, it will develop to emphasize switching tasks, moving quickly from one thing to the next, over focus. What one preeminent scientist, a guy who runs the Harvard Center for, I think it's Media and Child Health, something like that, said to me, Michael Rich, he said, bring back boredom. He said that's what he is telling parents to try themselves, but in particular parents to tell kids. Get them to focus on things so that their brains develop to emphasize concentration and not quick hits of stimulation. I said to him, Dr. Rich, can you prove to me that the brains are developing differently? And he said, can I prove it to you? Well, I know how you're asking the question, and I can't prove it to you the way you mean it. But he said, by extension, I can't prove to you that smoking kills. As doctors, we make inferences from a lot of strong evidence. And I can tell you, based on the evidence I see before me, I can tell parents and tell parents to tell kids, you got to disconnect more. You've got to multitask less because your brain development can be at stake.
We, unfortunately, have to quit. You want to give me 30 seconds on Devil's Plaything?
Okay. It's my new novel coming out. It's drawn from some of this stuff, and I'll give you the very quick premise, which is a seasoned investigator in San Francisco, you know, picture me, but taller and handsomer, because that's how we all write ourselves as novelists. And he's got a grandmother who suffers severe dementia. He's very close with her. She knows a terrible secret about the world, but because of her dementia, she doesn't know what it is. And he is trying to elicit the secret from her and save the world. And if it matters at all, Publishers Weekly just gave us a rave review yesterday, which has my wife and two children who aren't old enough to read yet still giddy.
All right. Matt Richtel, he's a novelist, a cartoonist, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. If you'd like to read his stories about our brain on computers or the dangers of multitasking while driving, you can go to The New York Times and read them there. He won a Pulitzer for the stories about driving and cell phone use. His two novels, the first, Hooked, was a bestseller, and the new one is just coming out, Devil's Plaything. He'll be here on our campus next week to talk about journalists and scientists and how they relate to one another. It's a special lecture, The Scorpion and the Frog. That is the title. That'll be Thursday, April 7th, 11 in the morning in the Beckman Auditorium on the U of I campus. And Matt, hey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was great. I appreciate it.